So everybody had some nice lunch? Yes, you managed to find something to eat? Yeah. No one just ended up wandering the back streets of Newtown? That's good. Okay, so for this next teaching session, we're going to look in some... I'm going to give an overview of the field of early Buddhism, and of course you will appreciate that this is a large field. Even in the course as a whole, we're really only going to do an introduction and touch on some of the important things. And so in this session, it's just giving a very kind of bird's eye overall survey of the field. So at least we can get some perspective as to what it is that we're dealing with. Right, so when we talk about early Buddhism, right, what's early Buddhism? Well, define it how you like. I think of early Buddhism as what the Buddha taught, basically. What people did in the lifetime of the Buddha and shortly afterwards. So what do we have that... Oh, just to clarify, actually, there's probably an overall perspective. I meant to put a timeline in here, something I forgot. But just to give you a general timeline, time frame. Now, the Buddha lived roughly 500 years BC. So you'll find various dates for the Buddha's life mentioned, and in fact, none of the dates are known with particular certainty. But the tendency in modern scholarship is to assign the date of the Buddha's passing away, the Buddha's parinibbana, at roughly 400 BC, or perhaps a little earlier, between 400 and 420 BC. That's a sort of emerging consensus over the last decade or so. And that timing is referred to in Buddhist studies as the median chronology. Several chronologies for the Buddha's life have been proposed, some of them longer, some of them shorter, and this one is a kind of middle way compromise chronology. Actually, originally proposed by Thomas Rhys Davids, who we met earlier in the session, and like so many things, quite remarkable, really, that after 100 years and so many advances in scholarship, that often tends to reinforce and reconfirm his initial suggestions as it does to refute them. So these days, most of the scholars who specialize in Indology will take a date around 400 BC, maybe a little earlier. So we'll assume that median chronology. So from the median chronology, a rough timeline is that the Buddha lived for 80 years, so the Buddha was born around 500 BC, yeah, or a bit later, died around 400 BC. About 100 years after that, so we're talking about 300 BC, was what they call the Second Council. Okay, so the First Council was held immediately after the Buddha died, Second Council 100 years later. Around the time of the Second Council, probably a bit before, was the time of Chandragupta, who was the first Mauryan emperor. Okay, so the first emperor who covered the whole of India, pretty much. And a little bit before Chandragupta, so maybe 60 years after the Buddha, was the invasion of India by Alexander the Great. So from that time, we had the Greek presence in the northwest of India. King Ashoka, of course, the dominant figure in the period, and his dates usually given around 250 BC. From the time of King Ashoka, we have, of course, that's the first time when we have widespread and abundant archaeological remnants, his writings, his inscriptions, and so on, which refer to the Buddhist community, Buddhist ideas, and to Buddhist texts. Following the time of Ashoka, Buddhism spread to all the different parts of the greater India, to as far as Sri Lanka in the southeast, and as far as Gandhara and Kashmir, which is modern-day Afghanistan, in the northwest, to the east, possibly to Burma. According to the accounts, the Buddhist accounts say that Buddhism went to Burma in that time, but there's no actual archaeological record of Buddhism in Burma until quite a few hundred years later. But it was certainly in the west of India, and soon afterwards through to China and Persia and so on. So that brings us up to the end of the first 500 years. So it's convenient to divide the history of Buddhism in India into 500-year periods. That first 500-year period we can refer to as the early period of Buddhism. The second 500 years from about the time of Christ to 500 AD is often called the middle period. And in that period we saw the rise of the Mahayana and the development of the mature Abhidhamma schools, and in the last 500 years, from 500 to 1000 or a bit later, we saw the emergence of the Tantra schools and the logical schools of philosophy, and we saw the gradual eclipsing of Buddhism by Hinduism in that period. So that's from about 500 AD onwards. Now we're concerned with only the early period for this course. And particularly we're talking about early Buddhism. So early Buddhism is like a subset of the early period of Buddhist history, just to clarify the terminology here. The early period of Buddhism is about the first 500 years, but we're really only concerned with the first 100 years or so, the time of the Buddha's life, and immediately afterwards. So what is there from that time that we can reasonably say derives directly from that historical period? Okay, the Pali Canon, Pali Tripitaka, which is the canon of Buddhist scriptures as passed down in Sri Lanka in the Pali language. There are many Buddhist texts available in Chinese translations, and a large number of those also stem from the early period of Buddhism. So they are essentially very similar. Chinese texts are essentially very similar to what we find in the Pali Canon. There are also some texts in Tibetan translation, in Sanskrit, and other Indian languages like Gandhari, Uyghur, various Prakrits, hybrid Sanskrit, and other dialects. So this is kind of fragmentary material. The Tibetan material is translations and parts of translations which are preserved in the Tibetan canon. Sanskrit materials are usually recovered from either two sources. Sanskrit and other languages are recovered from two sources. One is from more or less chance finds in moldy monasteries in Nepal and Tibet. And a lot of this exploration was done by some of the European and later Indian scholars. One of the great figures there was Rahula Sankritayana, who's a great Indian scholar monk of the 20th century. And he travelled through Nepal and Tibet and so on, going through all of these monasteries and searching through to find Sanskrit manuscripts, many of which were nearly 1,000 years old. Okay, so the Tibetan tradition had passed down their scriptures in Tibetan language. And these were manuscripts which had been brought from India to Nepal and Tibet and preserved often for nearly 1,000 years. And now been edited and published. The other main source of the Sanskrit and other languages is from chance archaeological finds. So this is where people do excavations in monasteries. A lot of them are found in jars. So they'll make these big clay jars, and which are buried, and in them they'll find some manuscripts. Okay. Now, often given the, shall we, delicate and unstable situation in Kashmir, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all these areas, it's very hard to do this work. Manuscripts don't survive in the main part of India. It's too humid and wet, same in Sri Lanka. There's no old manuscripts, right? They get moldy and fall apart. But in the dry, desert-like country, then they can survive if they're protected. So what a lot of these manuscripts are is where there was quite interesting that when they started reading these manuscripts, what they found was that these manuscripts are written, and some of them are nearly 2,000 years old. Right? They're carbon dated actually by Mark Allen from Sydney Uni, and they're now the earliest Buddhist manuscripts or earliest Indian manuscripts of any sort. Okay, and they're nearly 1,000 years old. And when they started reading these things, they were written in handwriting, and then on the top of the handwriting, scrawled above it, was another word. It said Likitan. And the word Likitan literally means written. Okay? So they're kind of very puzzled. Why are all these manuscripts? Why does somebody write written on top of a manuscript? I mean, obviously it's written. You can see that it's written. And this is a kind of great puzzle. And then they figured out the answer to it, that Likitone doesn't mean written, it means copied. Yeah? So these are all the old copies from the monastery library, which are a bit worn out, and somebody's made a new copy of them, and they've got the old ones, put them in these jars, and buried them. Yeah? And so that's the versions that we have today. Yeah? And it's an incredible job to read these things. I mean, they're in, sometimes it's just a letter, or half a letter. Right, and you have to piece these things together and identify them, find which ones in Pali or Sanskrit that they're similar to, and then gradually reconstruct them. And this is an ongoing project, mostly done by German scholars at the moment, but also a team of American scholars, Richard Solomon, and as I said, Mark Allen at Sydney Uni is one of the main figures in that field. So this is where some of those texts are coming from. In terms of archaeology, unfortunately, there's stuff all, in technical terms. There's no monasteries, there's no cities to speak of, there's no monuments, there's no stupas, there's nothing from the Buddha's life. There's in fact no significant archaeological remains at all, and very little significance. I mean, what you have in India, of course, you have the Indus Valley Civilization, which is 1,000 years earlier, right? And that's been quite well investigated, quite well known, because they built huge cities, right? And the Indus Valley is very remarkable, and is now even more remarkable. Just last week, they published a paper saying that they've now discovered that the Indus Valley invented curry. Yes! Turmeric, ginger, and garlic, all been identified in the cooking remains in the Indus Valley Civilization, yeah? So that's where curry comes from. Yeah, that, well, it's obviously the spices are there as preservatives, so yeah, it's doing a good job. Yeah. So then there was that early period of urbanisation in India ended, and there weren't any large cities for several hundred years. And in time, the Buddha, that was re-emerging, but the buildings were of wood, so basically nothing has remained. And this, of course, is very disappointing and a bit of a hassle for those of us who want to study things historically. It would be lovely to have monastery remains and so on, but all of those things we only have from a slightly later date, from the time of Ashoka or a bit afterwards.
Yeah, sure, if we just scoop up where he's remained.
Sure. So there's stupas and so on in all of these places, and it's quite likely that many of those might be quite early, but of course they've been successively built up over so many generations that it's difficult to know actually what was there in the beginning. So yes, there may well be, you know, both Gaya stupa and these important places, quite possibly there was you know, an early core, because that's what they tended to do with the stupas. They wouldn't demolish them. They would build a simple monument, and then generations would come and build more and more on the outside, yeah. So, yeah. But as far as like the confirmed excavations, yeah, there's very little. There's from that period. Oh, we'll go into that a little bit later. But anyway, there's little archaeology. Okay. Pali Tripitaka. A bit of an overview here. So with the Pali Canon, and please, as we get into these more technical things, then please do ask questions. Make sure that I'm not just yes. Oh.
Could you talk a little bit about the nature of Pali, the language, and how it relates to the languages that the Buddha
may have previously
spoken.
Okay, yep. Okay, so here it has exactly that. The early canon in one's called the Middle Indo-European dialect or language of Pali, which was an Indian dialect, perhaps from Avanti. Pali, this is an area of some controversy in Buddhist circles. In Theravada, it's always more or less assumed that Pali was the language that the Buddha spoke. Modern scholars give a more nuanced position, but it's actually not really wrong to say that Pali was the language the Buddha spoke. The Buddha spoke a dialect which must have been very, very close to what Pali was. We saw in the, if you remember in the introduction, we looked at those two verses and the Pali and the Sanskrit, and we saw how similar they are. Well, the language that the Buddha spoke in all likelihood is less different from Pali than Sanskrit is, right? So even those few differences, the actual difference that the Buddha spoke of is probably less than that. It's just a different dialect. It's probably no more than the difference between English and Scottish, right? Which might be quite a big difference. Maybe that's a bit of an example. Or like, you know, English as spoken in Vaucluse and Parramatta. No, that's not a good example. anyway, but you get the idea. It's a different dialect. So when you look at the Pali Canon is actually very standardized. The spelling is very standardized. The phrases are very standardized, and that's very much a characteristic of an artificial language. Okay, nobody speaks in a way that's so formal and that repeats the same phrases in that kind of way. So there's clearly an artificial process where it's been cleaned up and made consistent and so on and so forth. Now we don't know exactly where the Pali language comes from. But I suspect that the Pali language itself was invented for the purpose of writing the Pali Canon, that it's a slightly artificial language in that respect, not dissimilar from received English pronunciation, which is also an artificial language, or if you're in Thailand, Central Thai is also an artificial language. It's not a dialect of Thai, it's an artificial creation. Bahasa Malaysia is also an artificial language. Bahasa Indonesia is another artificial language. These are all kind of centralizing languages which standardize one form from the multitude of local dialects. So probably Avanti seems to be the most likely candidate. Avanti was the home of Venerable Mahinda, who was the son of King Ashoka, and he brought Buddhism to Sri Lanka. So remember, when in these days, when somebody goes to a place, right? So if a Buddhist monk goes to a place, they bring the scriptures with them because they're in their head, right? They're memorized. So he obviously would have spoken the scriptures in the language that was suitable for his dialect in his locality. And there seems to be some... It's difficult with the inscriptions because most of the inscriptions are somewhat later, so it's hard to confirm exactly where Pali came from, but the evidence seems to be that probably Avanti was the area. I'll just give you there's a map a bit further here, and you can see the... down here is Avanti. This is Magadha. This is the main area where the Buddha lived and taught in the Ganges Valley. And Avanti, slightly down on what they call the Dakina Patha, the southern road. And this is where Mahinda's mother was born, and where he spent time as a governor and so on. And this is on the route to Sri Lanka. It doesn't look like it, but actually when they went to Sri Lanka, they would go down here and then down this way, off the side of the map, down to Andhra Pradesh down here, and then over the ocean to Sri Lanka. So rather than going down here, that's how Mahinda went. So...
Is that West India?
This is West India, yeah.
Okay, is there anything else apart from the Buddhist texts?
Pali has a very copious literature, although for most of us, we don't really know what that is. But a lot of the later literature in Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka is written in Pali, and there's all kinds of things, medical texts, political treaties, poetry, legal texts, astrology, all kinds of things. Yeah, I just saw the other day a catalogue, it's like a whole book filled with kind of lists and lists of Pali texts, most of which I've never heard of. Yeah. I mean, a lot of those would be very localized. Things like, a lot of them would be things like a series of lecture notes that's sort of kept in a monastic tradition that they would use for teaching the students in that particular monastery. And so they would sort of summarize the Dhamma teachings in that way that they would teach there.
And what script do they use? Like, do they use the Vedanta as well? Or is there like a native Pali script?
No, there's no native Pali script, so, yeah.
Sri Lankans would write it in their alphabet.
That's right, yeah.
Thais would write it in their alphabet.
Exactly, yeah. All of the traditional countries, the alphabets are derived from the alphabet which we find on the Ashokan pillars, which is called Ashokan Brahmi. And so Sinhalese, Burmese, Thai, Cambodian, all of their scripts are derived from that, as is Devanagari in the modern Indian scripts. Traditionally, Pali is never written in Devanagari. Sometimes people like to write in Devanagari these days because they think that's somehow more authentic. But no, it's actually not. if you want to write in authentic fashion, if anything, you'd use the Shokanbrahmi as the oldest one. Yeah, but it really doesn't matter, because all of those scripts are purely phonetic. They just represent the sounds of the words, and this is one of the geniuses of Indian linguistics from that time. And the Indians had by far the most advanced linguistics in the world at that time and up until a couple of hundred years ago. And they analysed the languages perfectly and devised scripts that would represent them very perfectly. So we can then take that and represent in modern times. We use the Romanised form, and again, that's lossless. That conveys exactly the same as what you'd find in any of the traditional scripts.
So if you were to learn Pali today in Sydney, it's just as easy learning it.
You learn it in Roman script, yeah. Yeah. Unless you particularly want to read. The only reason for learning the other scripts would be if you want to read the manuscripts. Yeah. But for most of us, we don't bother.
On the log of palm leaves, is that, are they written in
Pali? Yeah, that's where you get the palm leaves. I'll just, we have one in here. This is an example of a Pali manuscript in a traditional script. Now this one is Burmese, so this is a Burmese script. As you can see, it's highly decorative. So this isn't the sort of ordinary palm leaf manuscripts that people use for practical purposes. This is obviously a ceremonial one. I can't read Burmese script, so I don't know what's on there. But usually, what these have is like Parimokkha or some Kamavacha or something like that. Might be some kind of auspicious verse or thing, but it's most likely is a Kamavacha, like an ordination chant or something like that. And these were done obviously for merit making and ceremonial purposes. And you know, you can see it's very beautifully done. The script is very beautiful, and I've actually been studying this a little bit too, as an example of the Buddhist typography and how you actually lay text out in the page in a way that's both very readable and also very beautiful. So, yep, that's just one example. So, okay, so the Pali texts, we have what we call the Tripitaka, the three baskets, and the three baskets are the suttas, the Vinaya, and the Abhidhamma. So the suttas, we have the five collections. So the collections in Pali, we usually call Nikaya. In the Sanskrit and Chinese versions, we usually use the word Agama, which means exactly the same thing. They just mean collection. Actually, in Pali, you often find in the old tradition that they would call them Agamas also. It's a bit of a shame that the modern convention has been to use the word Nikaya. But anyway, the Digha Nikaya is the long collection, Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, Samyutta Nikaya, connected discourses, Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, and the Kuddhika is the minor collection, so that's sort of a miscellaneous group of different texts, including things like the Dhammapada, the Sutta Nipata, the Jatakas, and various other works. Mostly of verse. Some of the books in the Kuddhika Nikaya are composed at a later date, so not all of the Kuddhika Nikaya is regarded as being part of early Buddhism in the sense that we're talking about here. Most of the things in the four Nikayas, the four main Nikayas, are considered to be what we call early Buddhism, although even there we do find some later interpolations. In the Vinaya Pitaka, Vinaya is, so the sutta is the most important, and that's of course it's talking about the doctrine, right? That's the actual teaching, so by far the most important. Second main part of early Buddhism is the Vinaya, and the main early part of the Vinaya is what they call the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Vibhanga, specifically the list of rules of discipline for the monks and nuns, what they call the Parimokkha. And they are definitely early. But most of the material in the Vinaya is somewhat later. On the whole, the Vinaya is maybe 100 or 200 years later than the suttas. But the core of it, the Parimokkha, is early, and the rest of it was built up around that. And this section we have here called the Khandakas is a section of 20 chapters, more or less, 20 chapters plus two, dealing with miscellaneous matters such as things like ordination procedure, duties in the monastery, disciplinary procedures, procedures for like shoes, what kind of shoes you're allowed to wear and how you should deal with them, how to, a whole section on how to keep toilets clean, right? Fantastic. Right, this is awesome. This is in India, like 2,500 years ago, and there's a whole chapter on how to keep toilets clean. Fantastic. And all these kinds of things. So all like practical things that are really useful and very interesting to see that kind of that day-to-day life and how things are organized. So in the Khandikas we see a lot about how the Sangha ran itself, how things were organized, as basically an anarchist collective. Right? The Sangha is an anarchist collective. There's no power structure of people telling you what to do, but all the monks and nuns are equal and everybody makes decisions together. There's consensus decision making. Property is held in common. And so essentially it fulfills the definition of an anarchist collective. I got in trouble in Thailand for saying that. And finally we have the Abhidhamma Pitaka. So the Abhidhamma essentially is the systematized, more scholastic presentation of the Dhamma, and the Abhidhamma on the whole is later than the Suttas and the Vinaya, but all of these things were sort of evolved over a period of time. So when we say earlier and later, it's not like one was started and finished and then another one was started and finished. It's just like a generalization. They actually were kind of evolving over the similar periods. The Abhidhamma on the whole is later. But there are some passages and quotes and so on within the Abhidhamma which also come from the early period. Okay? In fact, we find that in every period of Buddhism, that people will quote from and refer to things, right? Doesn't matter where you look at. Right? Even in modern days, people do that, don't they? You quote from the suttas. So parts of it actually are early and parts are late. So that's an overview of the Pali Tipitaka. Now, we're going over time here. It's time to do some sitting, do some meditation for the next 10 minutes.
Is the Pali Tipitaka practically the same in Sri Lanka, Burma and Thailand? Or?
Pretty much, yeah. There's a few minor variations in readings and spellings and so on, always in the different manuscript traditions. And there's a few books which are technically not regarded as canonical in Thailand and Sri Lanka, which are regarded as canonical in Burma. These are kind of later additions to the canon. But the books themselves are still found. It's kind of nominal difference whether they're regarded as canonical, and that's the Melinda Panha, Neki Pekarana, and the Petako Vedesa. Essentially it's the same. Yeah.
And are all monks these days supposed to memorize it by heart as well?
Oh, no. One or two monks will memorize it by heart, yeah, but most of us might memorize a bit.
But in Buddha's time, were just one monk memorized a lot, or did they split?
They usually would split it into bits. Actually, this is where this classification, what it is used for, was that they would usually divide the recitation, because these are all oral scriptures, right? There was no writing used for sacred scriptures in that time. So to facilitate the memorizing of it, what they did is they divided into basically schools. So one school of Diga reciters, a school of Majjhima reciters, a school of Sanyutta reciters, and so on. And then within that school, they would further subdivide. So you'd learn like a basic curriculum of texts, and then you would go further to learn different groups. And so they'd manage it so that everyone had enough that they could learn. Obviously, people who have very good memories could then learn the whole lot, and other people would learn a certain part of it. And then they would come together regularly and do reciting together, what they call sangiti, literally means reciting together. So, of course, by reciting together, you know, hey, what are you doing? That's not in there. And this one, where'd you put that one? I thought you know, it was a bit short. I thought I'd like make it a bit longer. No, you can't do that. And so this is how they ensured the transmission. People often people in modern times have this idea that oral texts are somehow less reliable than written texts, and there's no evidence for this at all. In fact, quite the opposite. Written texts are very easy to change. You know, you just need one copyist to introduce the changes in the text. It happens all the time in manuscript traditions. Whereas with oral traditions, if it's preserved in the right way, and the Indians had developed these very sophisticated methods for memorizing texts, and we know that, for example, the Rig Vedas, the ancient Hindu scripture, was passed down in the oral tradition for probably well over 2,000 years before it was written down, and it preserves identically the linguistic forms from 2,000 years previously. I mean, we know that. This is well known among linguists. You can study the evolution of languages and so on. You know the language must come from that time. And not even a syllable or a spelling or anything has been changed. Yeah? It's preserved identically. This is quite possible that this happens. Obviously, changes were made in the transmission. And the fact that it's an oral transmission would affect the manner in which those changes would happen, right? But it doesn't mean that it's inherently any more or less reliable than a written transmission. It does mean it's more work. It's oral tradition. So the Pāṇita-pitaka, now the early parts of the Pāṇita-pitaka is essentially what we have on that table there, which, minus the coffee, was originally meant to be a display of what we have from the elite Buddhist text, okay? So the coffee jar was a later interpolation, not part of the early Buddhist tradition, but as I said earlier, sometimes things are added later and they're also good. So so on that table we have, on the left, we have the Vinaya-pitaka, which is the code of discipline. Okay, so these are all English translations. And then next to that we have the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya. Again, all in the English translations. And then we have a few of the books from the Kudaka Nikaya. There's actually a few others which are missed out there. But that's pretty much the corpus of scriptures from early Buddhism. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about early Buddhism. And, of course, the various parallels in the Chinese and so on, which we'll get to. Which 99% of which are merely variants on what we find in there. Basically the same, only very minor differences to what we find there. So this is essentially what we're talking about. Yeah?
Can you just tell me a bit, what body comprised that second council?
Second council?
Yes. To determine what was canonical and otherwise.
Okay, well, the decision on what was canonical and the formation of the canon itself, primarily, it seems, happened in the first council, immediately after the Buddha passed away. Now, in the Buddha's lifetime, the scriptures, of course, were being memorized and passed down, and the collection in the earliest times was known as the nine angas, the nine groups of the Dhamma. It seems that in the first council, that was shifted from being the angas to being what we call the nikayas, and it seems that the reason for making that shift was to make the collection more systematic for the sake of preserving the Dhamma. Now, according to the traditional accounts, the first council was held in Rajagaha shortly after the Buddha passed away, presided over by Venerable Mahakasapa. Venerable Ananda was the main reciter of the suttas, and Venerable Upali was the main reciter of the Vinaya. And there was a group of 500 arahants who comprised that. Actually, that can't really literally be true. Anyone here been to Rajagaha? Anyone here been to Rajagaha? You've been to the Satapani cage where they held the first council? Yeah? It's very small. Yeah. You could not fit 500. You could fit 500 very, very small arahants in there. So unless they were practicing some psychic power to make them like the size of a thumb or something. I mean, there's obviously been some cave-ins and so on. It's difficult to estimate how big it was. But there just aren't any really big caves in that region. So either the council wasn't actually held in that cave, or it had a lot less than 500 monks in it. 500 is kind of a conventional number anyway. So basically it was a body of monks which was accepted as authoritative. That's the main point, is that, you know, all of the Buddhist traditions that we have look back to that council. So they all ultimately accepted that as being authoritative. As far as the second council goes, the earliest accounts of that, so this is talking 100 years after the events, the earliest versions of stories of that don't talk about the redaction of texts at that council. They merely talk about a disciplinary controversy which was at the time in the Buddhist community. later accounts do mention that texts were redacted there, and it seems reasonable to suppose that that did happen. I mean, you had this group of monks, and that was essentially a group of monks which was gathered from all over India. They travelled to Vaishali, which is in the central region where the Buddha lived, and you know, by that time there was already a kind of a dispersal of monks from different regions, and they were coming together to that place. And again, that council is regarded as authoritative in all the traditions, and that was the last time. Okay, so all subsequent councils are only found and mentioned within particular traditions, and they're regarded as authoritative within that tradition, but not within all traditions. The second council was the last time, it seems, that the Sangha really operated as a whole in ancient India, yeah, or at least the last record we have of that.
In modern times, have they tried to do it in the past decade or two?
What? Tried to do what?
Like a council like that?
Oh, well, they had the Sixth Council in Burma in the 1950s. Yeah, so that was there was monks from Burma, Thailand, and Sri Lanka, and they came together and recited the scriptures. Yeah. So most of the editions that we use in the Pali Canon today, at least nominally, stem from the Sixth Council.
And you said arahant, but sometimes people say arahat.
That's just Pali and Sanskrit difference. Yeah. Okay. So just moving along, Chinese canon. And the Chinese canon is very big. It's much bigger than the Pali canon. Basically, what seems to be the tendency is that in the Pali tradition, the canonical texts are sort of kept frozen and separate, and the literary development was in separate texts, which in the commentarial traditions and so on and so forth. But the Tripitaka was kept as it is, whereas in the Chinese and Tibetan canons, the early texts were kept there, but other texts were later, and they're also considered part of the Tripitaka. So the idea of it being Sutta Vinaya Abhidhamma doesn't really apply in the case of Chinese and Tibetan canons. It's more just a vast collection of all kinds of literature among which we find these things. So if we think, for example, these agamas, you know, if we think the Chinese Taisho canon would be about one bookshelf there, the whole bookcase, not one shelf, the whole bookshelf, and then the first four or five books on the top shelf would be the agamas, okay? And then the rest of it is mostly the later literature. Give you an idea of the proportion that we're talking about. Okay, earliest translations into Chinese were done by Anshagao, who died around 168 CE. So that's very early, isn't it, right? So Anshagao is a very interesting figure. He's a Parthian prince from Persia, right? And he renounced his claim to the throne, became a Buddhist monk in Persia, Iran or somewhere like that, and then walked to China, learnt Chinese, and translated a whole bunch of Buddhist texts into Chinese, right?
Okay.
168 he died. Yeah. So, and he translated, he was one of the first translators into Chinese, and most of his, he translated a miscellany of things, but most of his translations were from early Buddhist schools. However, the main translations we have of early Buddhist texts were made around 400 to 400 CE, okay? And that's the main collections of the Dirga, Madhyama, Samyutta, Ekotra Agamas, and the Vini, most of the Vini materials. They were all translated around that period. Okay, so the texts themselves obviously much earlier, but that's when they were brought to China and translated. And that period was a more, you know, that was one of the kind of the golden ages of translation into Chinese. You know, Anshagao was very much a pioneer, so a lot of his translations are quite rough and difficult to read later on, and these are much better translations. But still, not as the Chinese were always much more interested in the Mahayana texts, so that many of the great Mahayana sutras and texts were translated multiple times, and they have gradually refined until the translations were very beautiful and very well done. Whereas the Agama sutras tended to, the translations are not so easy to read and not so precise, so that's one of the reasons why they've never been so popular in China. But still, there's a lot of material there. Five complete vinayas, right? So it's a bit of a nightmare if you want to do vineyard study. It's not like just you can look at the Pali Vinaya and then that's all right now. Oh, oh God, it's not just 227 rules. It's 220, and it's another 250 in the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya, and there's another, huh? And there's the Savasivadin Vinaya, and then there's a Mish. And but what the advantage of it though, it does give much more opportunity for loopholes. Yes. So. So if that's your main objective in doing Vinaya studies, is to try to find ways out of keeping rules, then it's very helpful. Yeah. Especially mainly it's useful because if somebody says, this is such and such the rule, right? And then you can say, oh yes, but Mahishasika Vinaya this, and Mahasangika Vinaya that, and Nalakutra Wada. And by the time people's kind of eyes glaze over, and you know, brain fries, and then, you know, and then you can just do what you like. So that's good. But anyway, joking aside, so there's a very rich literature of Vinaya materials in Chinese, and of course that's a very wonderful source for study of early Buddhism. And Abhidhamma also, they have the seven books of the Sarvastivadin Abhidhamma, Vinaya, that should be Abhidhamma, not Vinaya there, and one book of the Dharmaguptaka, so a complete Vinaya of the Sarvastivadin school. I'll talk more about the schools in just a minute. It's just an overview. So the basic idea you can get from here is that we have the complete canon in Pali, of which this stuff here, most of the five Nikayas and much of the Vinaya is the early stuff, and you have the same thing in Chinese from some various schools, but even more, because they sometimes double up, especially the Vinaya, but also the Sutta, so they have even more, there's a greater quantity of material in Chinese. So in these studies, the Pali is always the basic reference, because the Pali is the oldest language, it's very precise and cleanly edited. Pali is a very nice language to read, it's very consistent, and the grammar is nice and clean and stuff. It's really easy to get a handle of Pali. I know those who did my Pali class last year won't necessarily agree with that, but it's all relative, right? So the Pali it's got a wonderful commentarial literature, and the texts are well understood and so on. So our understanding of early Buddhism is always primarily based on those Pali texts. But there's a greater quantity of material in Chinese. Now, generally speaking, the Chinese material isn't necessarily very useful. How useful it is depends on what kind of thing that you're looking for, right? If you're looking at a very small level, very small focus, for example, on the level of a word, then it's not very useful because a word has been translated. So if you want to say, well, what does the word vitaka, a Pali word, meaning thought, it's one of the jhana factors. So we want to know, what does vitaka mean? Yeah? Well, we can look at that in the Pali text and examine that quite precisely. But when we look at the Chinese translations, it's much harder because they've used a Chinese word to translate it, and some other translators use another Chinese word, and we're not sure if they're actually translating the same Indian term and so on. So if you look on the word level, it's not always that useful. But if you step back a bit, the meaning of the phrases, of the paragraphs, and of the suttas is exactly the same. Yeah? So if you have a slightly more removed focus, then if you want to see, well, does this sutta include the same passages as it does in the Pali version, and then the Chinese becomes very useful. So it really depends, how useful they are depends on what kind of inquiry that you're wanting to make. And here's a summary of other material other than the Pali and Chinese. There's a few dozen early suttas, either in complete form or quoted form in the Tibetan canon. Many of these have been translated in Peter Skilling's Mahasutras. Many of the others are currently being translated and studied by Bhikkhuni Dhammadinda, Juliana Martini. So hopefully they'll be published soon. Several texts also, as I mentioned before, from Indic Sanskrit and other Indic languages recovered from monasteries in Nepal and Tibet, or from archaeological finds, mostly fragmentary. Much of this material is unpublished, and even less has been translated. You know, a lot of these archaeological finds, I mean, it's like some camel dealer shows up at the market and like says, you want to buy a manuscript? And, you know, it's like, where does this stuff come from? You don't know. It just appears on the market. And, you know, it's just people come across things, you know? And so there's actually some major, a lot of it's fragments, but there's also some major collections. There's like two-thirds of a Dirgha Agama, like a Digha Nikaya. So two-thirds of a whole collection in Sanskrit has been found. And that collection is divided into two parts. One ended up in Japan, one ended up in Germany, No one knows really how they got there, but they obviously bought somehow. Quite likely there was a third part, which nobody knows where it is. But anyway, that's now with the German scholars, and they are editing it and publishing it. They're very thorough. They are German. It will be done. It will not be done soon. Okay. So, when we're looking at early Buddhism, we frequently refer to the schools. Now, we're not particularly interested in the schools as such, because we're mainly interested in the early period before the schools emerged. However, the schools, it's essential to know something about the schools because we received our textual transmissions through the schools, and we've received all of our transmission of Buddhism through the schools. Now, what happened was that each, after the Buddha died, of course the Sangha had its own mechanisms for coming together, reciting and keeping unity and so on. But gradually, there was more and more separation that emerged. This is a complex and controversial field of study, and if you want to know the answers to any of the controversies, then I know all the answers, alright? I wrote the book. Okay, so if you want to know the answers, sex and sectarianism, not sex and secretaries, which was introduced at one time. No, sex and sectarianism book I wrote a few years ago, which goes into all of these things in a lot of detail. So anyway, it's just a summary of that finding. This is different from what you read in most books. Most books are wrong. Okay? Just so you know. Okay? The schools emerged gradually in the period after King Ashoka. The main force leading to the emergence of the schools were the geographic dispersal of Buddhism during the time of King Ashoka. Some monks went to Kashmir, some to Gandhara in Afghanistan, some to the west, some to the east, some down to Sri Lanka. And it's like 3,000 kilometres or something from Sri Lanka to Afghanistan, right? I mean, how often are you going to do that, right? You're reciting your texts in your monastery in Sri Lanka. You know, how often is it going to occur to you, well, I better get together with my friends from Afghanistan to make sure that we're reciting the same text, right? It doesn't happen. It did actually happen sometimes. There is a story in the Sri Lankan commentaries of Yonika Dhammarakita, the Greek monk who came with his students from the west of India, Aparantika, to Sri Lanka for the opening of the Great Stupa. And there's also stories of Sri Lankan monks travelling to him. There's a fantastic story of this monk wanting to learn Abhidhamma, travelled from Sri Lanka to Gandhara to travel, or Aparantika, to travel to study with Greek Dhammarakita. Okay, and so this is something that, you know, most Sri Lankans don't know, that this Abhidhamma student, right, he studied from the Greeks. Right? Also interesting, this is a little bit of a sidebar here, but I don't know if you know, but Mahinda may have been Greek or partly Greek. I just made that up, but not quite. Chandragupta, right, Ashoka's grandfather, had a war with the Greeks, and in the settlement for the war, he gave them 500 war elephants, and they gave him a princess. Right, that's the swap: 500 elephants for a princess. Okay, that's the thing. So his wife, or one of his wives, was Greek. Right, and so Mahinda was his great grandson. Yeah. So there you go. Anyway. That's all, apropos of nothing. So, the schools emerged and they gradually diverged just naturally, geographically. There were also, of course, were doctrinal differences which emerged and which caused some of the splits in later years. Probably there were personality clashes and so on as well, which were not recorded. But of the 18 early schools, the most important ones for the study of early Buddhism are the ones which actually texts still exist. So these are the Theravada, which of course is the Sri Lankan school. Theravada is a bit of a misleading word. We use it in modern times, but actually the traditional word that they use to describe themselves is the Mahaviharavasins, the dwellers in the great monastery. And that's a more precise historical term, because it's actually all of the early schools, or many of them, can be considered to be Theravadan. In a general sense, but specifically the Mahaviharavasins, the dwellers in the great monastery, which is one of the main temples in Sri Lanka.
Forest dwellers.
Forest dwellers?
one thinks of Theravada as being the forest tradition.
No, no, no. Theravada doesn't mean forest tradition. Yeah. No, no, no. Most forest tradition is like a movement within Theravada, but actually you find forest traditions in any school of Buddhism. Yeah, it's not really a school as such. Yeah. Sarvaskivada settled mostly in the northeast, Kashmir and Mathura. So from the Sarvaskivada, we have most of their suttas. We have their Vinaya and we have their Abhidhamma. So we have a probably 80% complete collection of Sarvastivada literature. Mula Sarvastivada, this is very closely related schools, and we're not always able to tell when a particular sutra or text belongs to one or the other. They're very similar. They both use classical Sanskrit to write their text in. But we have their Vinaya in Chinese, Tibetan and Sanskrit. And their Vinaya is huge, right? The Vinaya is ridiculously large. And exists in three languages, so good luck with that. Dharmaguptaka was the group from Gandhara, northwest of India, founded by Yonika Dhammarakita, so probably founded by a Greek monk, and they were, we have of them the Vinaya, the Dirga Agama, and one Abhidhamma book. I should also note in passing that the in terms of the Vinayas, that the Tibetan tradition follows the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. The Chinese and East Asian tradition follows the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. So all of the Buddhist traditions have always followed the Vinayas from the early schools of Buddhism, and the difference between Mahayana and early Buddhism is more in terms of the certain sutras and practices and so on, rather than the monastic code as such. Mahasanghika, also one of the early schools. The first or main split was between the Mahasanghika group of schools and the Theravada group of schools in the broad sense. Actually, all of these schools can be considered as Theravada in the broad sense, except for Mahasanghika. And of the Mahasanghikas, we have the Vinaya and some suttas. Mahasanghikas were, among other things, you remember the Bamiyan Buddhas, blown up by the Taliban a number of years ago. And so they were in a Mahasanghika monastery. Okay, and the last one is Mahishasaka, another one of the early schools. And Mahishasaka, we have their Vinaya, which was actually taken to China from Sri Lanka. Okay, so that's an overview of what we have. Let's sit for a meditation for another 10 minutes. How do we know what's early, what's late, and how do we make these kinds of decisions? We're going to look more in detail at the methodology in the next workshop. But for now, just an overview, some of the things that are important. One thing which is so fundamental that we sometimes forget it is the testimony of tradition. What I mean by that is, well, how does the tradition itself treat things? Huh? And for example, if you look in the Pali tradition, the suttas are always said to be spoken by the Buddha, right? Whereas the Abhidhamma is not actually said to be spoken by the Buddha. The commentaries much later claim that it was spoken by the Buddha, but the Abhidhamma itself is just there. It doesn't actually say that it was spoken by the Buddha. So that kind of testimony is actually quite important. If something doesn't even claim to be the words of the Buddha, then it's hardly unlikely that it is. Yeah? The traditions all point back to these fundamental Nikayas and the Vinaya as being the earliest sources, and this we find universal. So that's something which should be taken seriously. Second thing which is important is the concordance of the texts, both the suttas and the Vinaya. When we find the same text preserved in the same way in different traditions, then that's a strong indication that it has been preserved from a very early time. Now remember that most of our sources of text that we have, the Pali is from Sri Lanka, and most of the other ones, as it happens, and this is purely by historical coincidence, but probably 90% of the other texts are from the northwest of India, from the Gandhara, Kashmir region, around modern-day Afghanistan and Pakistan. For a variety of reasons, partly because, as I mentioned, the manuscripts can be preserved there better, but also partly that was the kind of the nexus of trade with China and where they went up there. So there were different reasons. They have been separated by 3,000 kilometres since the time of King Ashoka. Yeah? And yet, despite the fact that, so from a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, these schools were separated by 3,000 kilometres, and yet they preserved the texts word for word in identical form. Not just one or two, but literally thousands of texts have been presented in an almost word for word identical form. And to say that, well, that tradition was capable of doing that, right, is capable of preserving for 2,200 years these texts in an identical form, but they couldn't do that for the first 200 years, right, to me is just completely irrational. And so this is a very, very strong argument that if we know that they preserved those texts in identical form for 2,200 years, and so it seems reasonable that that was also what was done for the early period of Buddhism for the first couple of hundred years before they were separated. Yes?
Presumably, up until the Buddha's death, he would have given the talks himself. And the day after, at which point do the suttas become suttas?
What do you mean? At which point do they become? You mean at which point do they become an objective text rather than just something that somebody says? Well, I think that was an ongoing process during the Buddha's life. You know, people were memorizing them. I think that the Buddha. I think it's clear that the Buddha deliberately phrased his teachings so that they could be memorized. Yeah. And the suttas are full of all of these kinds of techniques for memorizing things, use of similes, use of repetition, use of formal structures, yeah? All of these kinds of things that you still find today. You know, it's very interesting for me to look at this. For example, if you look at any kind of technical literature today, any kind of technical documentation, what do? Well, they have a structured document, title, headings, subheadings, sections, and so on and so forth, and that allows you to navigate through the document. And that's exactly what we find in the Buddhist scriptures. Any scripture of any length is structured in that kind of way. Very clearly defined passages, introduction of themes, recapitulation, and so on and so forth. And these are found at every level, from the level of the individual words and the repetition of the words, the level of the sentences, the level of the paragraphs, the passages, the suttas as a whole, the collections as a whole. We find similar principles being applied all the way through. So one way of thinking about that is as a fractal phenomenon. Yeah? So you're familiar with the idea of fractals in mathematics as being kind of self-similar at different levels. Yeah? So the Buddhist scriptures have that fractal quality, that those patterns of repetition, formalization, and so on, self-similar at different levels, at the small and greater levels. Yeah.
I remember reading a sutta where a monk explained the Dharma in one way, and then some other monks went to Buddha and said he explained it in that way.
Right.
It was incorrect, and Buddha said, "Go and get him." And
right.
So to me, that sort of says that even then, Buddha was saying, "No, you said it wrong. That bit was right," so it was sort of was like quality control or something.
That's right, yeah, there was a dialogue going on, and that happened in various forms. Sometimes the Buddha say it was wrong, sometimes he'd say, yes, it was right, that's exactly what I would have said. Other times, and this is the interesting one, there's like four or five who all explain it in different ways, and the Buddha says, oh, they're all pretty good, yeah, but this is the way I would have done it. Yeah, so there's these different cases, yeah. But that's quite right, and that process was ongoing right from the beginning. Interpretation, the Buddha encouraged people to phrase things in their own way, and clearly there was a lot of leeway with that, and the most important thing was the essence of the teaching was there. Yeah. Okay, so another important thing is the evolution of the doctrine. This is something that you only kind of learn to appreciate when you know the teachings well, but if you know the teachings well, you can very clearly see that, you know, there are fundamental teachings, and then those teachings are developed and evolved. For example, in the Abhidhamma, there's new terminology introduced, new concepts introduced, certain things which are found in the early texts are changed, and so on. And then the next level, that will be developed further, and the next level, that's developed further, and so on. And you can see this evolution of doctrine, not just with one or two things. You can see it with virtually everything. And you can pretty much pick any topic of significance in the Buddhist texts at random and say, let's trace the evolution of that through the different strata of Buddhist texts, and you can see that similar processes have happened with pretty much everything. Yeah? That's not to say that the doctrine's, you know, been changed or corrupted or whatever. It's just that it's presented in new ways with new ideas and new language and so on. So this is also a way of tracing things back to the earliest situation. Another important one is the political, social, and technological conditions. I'll come to that soon. Chandragupta and Ashoka. I mentioned this a bit earlier, but we know from the reigns of King Chandragupta and Ashoka, the great Mauryan empires, emperors who ruled India, in Chandragupta's case, about 80 years after the Buddha, and Ashoka sometime after that, from that period we start to have very concrete historical evidence. We have reports by Greek ambassadors who were saying what was going on in India at the time. We have the extensive record of the Ashokan inscriptions and so on. And these all depict a situation which is somewhat later than the situation found in the early Buddhist texts. And the early Buddhist texts never mention either of these kings or anybody else from a later period. Remember how tempting that would be, right? To you know, you could write a sutra saying that the Buddha predicted there will be a great king in the future called Ashoka, and he will rule and he will be a great wheel-turning monarch. It would be very politically convenient to write that kind of thing. And the Buddhists did write that kind of thing, right? But they put it in their later texts. Right? They didn't put that kind of thing into the early texts. Even it's the same thing we find with the evolution of doctrine. Even in cases where the later tradition developed ideas which are quite different from those found in the early suttas, what they did was they gave some interpretation to explain away the different teaching. But they didn't change the text itself, generally speaking. There's always exceptions to everything, but generally that's what we find.
Okay. Do you think you're a little bit in danger of Theravada imperialism? Like, I mean, maybe I'm the only Mahayana person here today, I don't know. But, I mean, I don't have a chance to debate with you. I just know I won't win. You'll just demolish me. But, to just say, this is what Buddha taught in its essence. This is the, you know, we have evidence of this. We have empirical evidence of this. Like, the majority of Buddhists in Australia are Mahayana. And for them, what they practice comes directly from the Buddha. And most history is written by the victor. History, like, just because what was popular at the time was written down and then collected in the Pali Canon, you know, doesn't mean that if something was left out, it wasn't the teaching. It just means that that's what was popular and well known. Yeah. And also, like, I mean, we don't have a lot of evidence of kind of the unbroken lineage, but there were times in Tibet where one particular lineage was only known by two yogis, master and disciple. And then maybe later on they got some really influential disciple, a king or something, and it became really widely known. So whoever championed a particular vehicle or method of practice at a particular time is what became widely disseminated. But it doesn't mean that minor traditions were not present.
Sure. Yeah.
So, like, there is a certain danger that if you say, yes, this is what the Buddha taught, that, picking up his belt
because he doesn't have any discussion. Yeah, well, I mean, it's an important point. I don't want to cut you off, but I did say that the questions during the talk should be just brief questions because I do have quite a lot of things to get through.
Right. So it's just that, you know, there could become this kind of Puritanism that, well, you know, this is what we have and this is, you know, in the Pali Canon, this is Theravada and this is what Buddha taught, you know, it's like a little...
But I did warn against that in the beginning, yeah?
Yeah.
So you know, that's...
that if Mahayana came later, it's not the authentic teaching of the Buddha, rather it's a cultural adaptation, which most Mahayanas would not accept.
Yeah. Most Mahayanas are not here. The people who come here have come here because they're interested to learn what early Buddhism is. Yeah. So, what can I say? You know, I mean, if somebody says XYZ Sutra was spoken by the Buddha, and then I can say, well, look, you know, we know from linguistic and doctrinal and social and so on reasons that it was written in such and such a time. I mean, that's just a historical fact.
Yeah, but 300 years ago, we know what we know now based on the facts we have now. 300 years ago, we didn't know where the four holy places of Buddhism were in India.
Mm-hmm.
What we know just changes and grows all the time. It's like the blind man with the elephant, you know. What we know changes gradually over time, what we discover.
Yeah, but it
doesn't mean that we can say, yes, definitely, this is it. But that's, this is what we know now.
But that's... This is an important discussion, but I will have to cut it off because I have this presentation I want to get through, and this will go on endlessly. All I can say is, I'm not meaning to you know, and I've repeatedly said this during the discussion, is that what people do with their traditions is drawn from the early Buddhist tradition and is adapted to those time and places, and it includes things which are good and things which are bad and things you want to keep and things which you don't. And I've said this many, many times, okay? So, personally, I'm not all that interested in later Buddhism. I look at those things and I find there's not actually that much which is that interesting to me. So what I'm here to teach is early Buddhism for people who are interested in it. And people who want to know, well, why do you regard these ones as early and these ones are late? Well, these are some of the reasons why. Yeah? So, of course, any evidence is partial and incomplete, right? So we take an empirical approach to that. That's all we can do.
There are so many things in the Buddhist teachings which are very hard to prove empirically, like the six realms, or Buddha shooting a pillar of water and a pillar of fire out of his body, or devas, or, you know, enlightenment even. So there's still a lot of stuff that we accept, you know, based on tradition and experience, and we don't have empirical proof for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that's relevant. But anyway, look, can I just ask that we leave that aside?
Okay, sure.
There's something to be discussed, but that's why we have the discussion groups, is to discuss things. Yeah? but the questions during this time should be just for clarification. Yeah? Yeah.
Were the teachings, were they actually in Pali?
Buddha spoke in Pali? In a dialect that's very similar to Pali.
But it's not actually Pali?
Probably not. He probably spoke in different dialects in different places, I would think.
Okay. I wonder if it's something similar to the Burmese language, where they'll have one spoken language and then they'll have another more formalised way of writing.
Uh-huh.
So it is the same language, but it's just formal.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nominal difference. Is it the same language or a different language? Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Pali is clearly a slightly formalised language, yeah. Okay, moving onwards. So what is early? Most of the doctrinal passages which we find in the suttas that are actually attributed to the Buddha. That means I'm making a distinction here between the teachings which the texts actually say the Buddha spoke and the teachings which are framing narratives. Okay? So the framing narratives is, you know, thus have I heard at one time the Buddha was staying in Sarvatiya, Jetta's Grove, and so on and so forth. Most of the doctrinal passages are authentic, but only some of the framing narratives. Okay? Why is that? Well, because in the early days, the imperative, of course, was to remember the teaching. That's what people really wanted to do. That was important. So that's what they would have taken a lot of care about. Remembering the background details, where it was spoken, when it was spoken, to whom it was spoken, and so on, this is usually not so important. And a lot of the times those things are just added by way of convention and later on. If we compare the different texts from the different Chinese, Pali, Tibetan, and Sanskrit versions, in almost all cases, we find that the doctrines, the teachings actually attributed to the Buddha are identical word for word, whereas the framing narratives quite often might be different. One sutta is set in Rajagaha, another sutta is set in Savatthi, one sutta is given to a certain monk, another one is given to another monk, these kinds of differences. But the teachings are usually the same. The Padimokkha is the list of rules for monks and nuns, and some other material in the Vinaya, but as I said, for the Vinayas as a whole are somewhat later than the Padimokkas. Sorry, than the Padimokkha and then the Suttas. some verses, like some of the Dhammapada verses and other similar gathas, and also occasional passages and quotes that we find in the later literature. So this is more or less a summary, kind of the results of a fairly generic consensus of what's regarded as early Buddhist material in scholarly circles. Of course, you know, when we try to work out the details, right, you can always disagree about it. Scholars have to disagree, otherwise they don't keep their job, right? You've got to have stuff to write papers about and so on, so you've got to prove how the last guy was wrong and stuff. But on the whole, this is what we usually regard as being early. What's not early? Abhidhamma, mostly was composed probably 200 plus years after the Buddha. Most of the Jatakas, some of the Jatakas are early stories, but they were probably adopted into the Buddhist tradition somewhat later. Not that much later, because we see the Jatakas depicted in inscriptions in Bharut and Sanchi from about 200 BC. A series of late books in the Kudaka Nikaya, so this is also in the Pali canon, but in the minor collection, the Peta Watu, Vimana Watu, these kind of ghost stories and stories of heaven. Charyapitika is the life of the Buddha, Buddha Vansa, again, story of the life of the Buddha, and so on. Most of the Vinaya I would date between 100 to 200 years after the Buddha. Mahayana texts, first evidence we have for Mahayana texts is some early translations which are about 600 years after the Buddha. So we assume that they're in existence for some time before that, so maybe 400 years or so after the Buddha we can trace the advent of the Mahayana. Most of the Mahayana texts composed within that period, about 400 to 1,000 years, although some of the Tantric texts composed even much later than that, up to 1,500 years after the Buddha. Some parts of the Nikayas and Agamas, then even though I've said that most of the material there can be regarded as early, but some of it clearly is not. Some of the verses are written in late metrical styles, and this is one of the key literary features that we can use to identify the evolution of texts. The style of poetry changed radically in India, and so we know that some of the verses were late, some of the legendary elaborations, some passages which are not common between the different versions, some which show an influence of the Abhidhamma and so on, and also the various legendary lives of the Buddha which were composed in all of the traditions.
Can I ask where the tikkas would fit into that?
The tikkas? Oh, again, much later again.
Okay.
Yeah, so the commentaries in the Pali tradition date from about the 400 AD, yeah, so about 900 years after the Buddha, yeah, and then the Tikkas, the sub-commentaries, are much later than that again, up until the modern period, yeah. Okay, so
are we thinking for Buddhists, the main purpose of learning Buddhism,
yep,
is to attain Nirvana, not to be born again. So, does it matter, what Buddha taught was how to understand the Dukkha, and then how to attain Nirvana, how to not to be born again. So,
I don't know if it's important, but that's what the course is about. So you have to decide for yourself what's important, but you don't know if it's important until you've learnt it. Yeah? So maybe it's the case that everything that you've learnt is great and terrific and fine. You can come here and learn all about early Buddhism and then go and practice exactly as you were before, and it doesn't make any difference. And you've just learned a bit of knowledge and a bit of background in Buddhism. Yeah? And that's all. That's all. That's enough. Yeah? So you learned a bit of history and so on. That's good enough. But on the other hand, maybe what you've been doing is wrong. Maybe you've been taught something which comes from a mistaken interpretation of Buddhism. And what we might do is we might give you some tools that will enable you to tell the difference. Yeah, this happened to me. I'm going to give you my personal example. This is why I'm interested in these things. I first studied Buddhism at a monastery called Wat Rampang in Thailand. They taught this Mahasi Vipassana technique. It's all about mindful noting of everything in the present moment, and if you have any pleasant experiences, that's bad, get rid of it. And then I came out of that and I thought, okay, well, that's what meditation is. And I got all these kind of ideas about what meditation should be. And then I started reading the Buddhist scriptures. And they were talking about this jhana stuff, jhana, jhana, jhana. And no one had ever mentioned that. And I started noticing that the Buddha talked about happiness a lot. He said when you meditate, you find pleasure and happiness, and that's how you make your mind peaceful in meditation, and that's how you see things as they really are. And I hadn't been told anything like that on my meditation retreat. So it wasn't until I'd studied that, until I could realize that actually what I'd been taught wasn't really how the Buddha taught meditation, or perhaps was only one part of how the Buddha taught meditation, but there are other aspects to it which weren't being taught at all on that retreat. Okay? So that these things can have a very useful practical application. Okay, so we're going to have a look, just a brief survey, some of the background historical context. Now, much of this is covered in more detail in Buddhist India by T.W. Rhys-Davies, which was your background reading for this class. So I'll just summarize some of it here. In the time of the Buddha, the political situation, there was a mix of kingships and aristocracies. The Buddha, by aristocracy, people sometimes say democracies, but actually it wasn't really democracy in our modern terms. It was an alliance of the ruling class, the leading families who would make decisions collectively. So perhaps aristocracy is a better term than democracy, but certainly more democratic than the kingship model. That changed radically by the time of Chandragupta. All of the aristocracies were gone. The democratic model was gone, and it was all kingship. There were 16 great countries, they're called 16 Mahajanapada. Once again, that was gone by the time of Chandragupta and Ashoka. They'd all been swallowed up into the greater Magadha. And then this idea of the shifting sands of the situation at the time, even during the Buddha's lifetime, the smaller countries were being swallowed up by Magadha and Kosala. Okay, so these two empires which were battling over Benares, for example. Yeah, they had fights over who's going to be the lord of Benares. Magadha conquered Champa. They're gradually swallowing all of the other kingdoms around and unifying that cultural area. And that process is depicted very clearly in many places in the Buddhist texts themselves. So it's locating those Buddhist texts in a particular historical and political situation. A political situation that only existed in a very short period of time. Right? It was only those decades when that happened. Shortly afterwards, that situation was gone forever. They had all been swallowed up, and it was all one empire, which of course then broke up, and then there was another situation later on. And that is acknowledged. One of the readings that we gave was the Ratapala Sutta, and you had the wonderful dialogue between Ratapala and the king at the end of that, when he's talking about, what do you want? Well, if you gave me this shore, I'd go and get the far shore as well, yeah? And so this idea that the natural desire of a king is to conquer the whole country and to rule everything. Here's a map of the 16 Mahajanapadas. In the top left corner, you can see this is the section of India where the map is demonstrating. This area here is mostly where the Buddha lived.
Wait, we had a look before. It's actually the natural sunlight.
Oh, you can't see that. Okay. If you want to see more closely, you can just come up closer. There's not much I can do about that at the moment. Yeah. Okay, so this area is where the Buddha lived. Magadha was Rajagaha, Vajin Republic, Mala, Buddha's born up here, Sakyan Republic. Kosala is where Sarvati is, and down here to Benares and Kasi. So this is the main area where he went and lived, and he went up as far as the Kuru country near Delhi and gave several discourses up there, and then to down here to Kosambi and this area here. I don't know if he ever went as far as Avanti, but some of the monks in the time of, in his time went as far as Avanti, Aparantika in this region, which was regarded as a barbarian and uncivilized country at the time. And also Kalinga down in this area is also mentioned. So this is kind of the region which we find acknowledged and mentioned in the Buddhist texts. And we can see it's basically that area of northern India. Southern India is completely unknown. Sri Lanka is not mentioned at all. Sorry to my Sri Lankan friends, but that's just deal with it, all right? The Buddha did not go to Sri Lanka. Sorry about that. And the West and Persia. Greece is mentioned once. So really the geographical knowledge was confined in that area. And again, it's changed completely in the time of Ashoka, right? The time of Ashoka talks about the contemporary Egyptian kings who was ruling in Greece. You know, the world, it just expanded, right? And, you know, very soon after that, we find mention of China and so on.
Okay. I read recently an article that suggested maybe the Buddha, before his enlightenment, did it. University of Taxila.
No historical basis for that. No. It was quite common for people to study in Taxila, so it was a custom, but no, there's no mention of that in any early texts. Yeah. Taxila is in Gandhara, that's up in this region, and that was a historical centre of studies, especially in the Brahmanical tradition. Yeah. Okay, so technologies which are characteristic of the region, development and widespread use of iron. Yeah. Wooden buildings, so no archaeological remnants from it. Fired bricks were becoming used, but weren't common in that area, in that time. The most common thing that's found in terms of the archaeological record is called northern black polished ware. It's a particular kind of pottery which has a kind of glossy sheen on it, and it distinguishes that period up to about the time of Ashoka, about 600 BC to about 300 BC. You find the northern black polished ware, and that's very widespread. Basically, the region of northern black polished ware is the same as the region of the Mahajanapada. So it's a sort of a concrete example of that unified cultural region where they all shared more or less that same technology. And I was discussing this with some of the monks recently, and we were saying how curious it was that we couldn't find any reference to the northern black polished ware in the early Buddhist texts. And we were kind of looking through and thinking, where do they talk about the northern black polished ware? And then we realized, hang on, we eat out of the stuff every day. So of course this is the monk's bowl, you know, the classic monk's bowl is either made of iron or pottery, and it's glazed with that black colour, and that's obviously what the northern black polished ware was. Huh? So this is an example of that technology still being used. I don't know if it's exactly the same way it's produced, but same style. Okay, some social changes that's happening at the time. Money is starting to be used frequently. This is a major difference. In the Upanishads, which were a couple of hundred years before the Buddha, we don't find the use of money. Right? Cows were the measure of wealth. Cities are starting to emerge, right? But again, not that kind of really big. Cities, as we find under, you know, Pataliputra in the time of Ashoka, was probably a million people or more. So the city, you know, small cities, relatively small cities, but substantial. Trade is limited. It's actually mentioned in the Pali Suttas itself that trade is, Buddha describes trade as an example of a livelihood which is of little busyness and little duties. But also of little reward. Okay? So some livelihoods there's little duties and lots of reward. Some there's much duties and much reward, and so on and so forth. So trade was, I think, it was one of where there's little work involved, but also little return. So it's, you know, suggesting that it wasn't really very significant. And of course that changed again drastically shortly afterwards. The dominant livelihood, dominant food, is agriculture rather than pastoral. This again is a shift from the Vedic period, and in the Vedas, it's all about the cows, right? They were herdsmen, and now they're settled down, and it's agriculture. There's a sense, growing sense, that there's a unified cultural region through that 16 Mahajanapadas, and this is an important one. It's the unification of the Ganges in Yamuna for the purposes of trade. Just come back up to the map. I know you can't see it very well, but the Ganges comes down through here, and the Yamuna is here, Right? Now, you can see that there's this kind of sequence of countries up here going up to the northwest. This is called the Uttarapatha, literally the northern road, yeah? The northern way. So as I joke about my friend Bramali, who's from Norway, that this is the Norwegian tradition, okay, up here. And then there's the Dakinapatha, is the southern route down here. So Buddhism always followed these two trade routes. And this one, this trade route is dominated by the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers. So at this time, you can see that there's different kingdoms settled down all along the Ganges. So of course, that's going to cause big problems as far as trade goes. In the time of the Buddha, or a little bit earlier, Magadha swallowed up Anga, this country here. Yeah? So the next country downwards on the Ganges. During the time of the Buddha, Magadha swallowed up Kasi, which is here. Yeah? So you can see that they're gradually extending, and Ajatasattu built his capital on the Ganges River, right? Pataliputta. So they're gradually dominating that whole stretch of the Ganges, which obviously was one of the things which greatly facilitated trade and the growth of the economy in that period. And it's no coincidence, I think, that once that was accomplished, right, a generation or two after the Buddha, that's when you see that explosion in the inter-trade routes, the interconnectedness and so on. You can actually sail all the way down to the sea, go to Suvarnabhumi, go to Burma, go to Sri Lanka and so on, and bring the goods up to that far. So this was a major, I think, factor in that political change. Dakinapatha. That's down here, down from Kasi, Vansa, Cheti, Avanti, Asaka. Oh, that's not on a river as such, no. Yeah, it's an overland route. And this down here, these would be the main ports for trade from the west. So again, shortly after the time of the Buddha and Ashoka, there was a major trade opened up with Persia and then with Rome. And these trading ports, modern-day Mumbai area, was where the trading with Rome has come.
You mentioned Suvarnabhumi. What's that?
Suvarnabhumi is usually identified with Lower Burma. Yeah. The Thais say it's Thailand and the Burmese say it's Burma. Anyway, technology, society, geography, most of these things we've already referred to, so I'll just skip over that. Here's another example of the geography. Okay, so then the next part I was going to look at was more the teachings. Oops. And I have run out of time. So anyway, let's have a tea break. And we'll come back in half an hour and see what's going to happen next.
Yeah, of course. Two questions. One is, you know, soon after Buddha passed away,
yeah,
there was the first council.
Yeah.
And that's where Theravada came out of it, or was it just because what I learned in school years and years and years ago, and then so it's starting to recollect what happened there.
So, roughly speaking, yes. Generally speaking, yeah. But remember that there's two senses in which the word Theravada is used. Okay, so when we use Theravada in contemporary times, we mean, you know, Buddhism in Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand, right? Which all comes from the same school, ultimately the Sri Lankan school, but ultimately that all stems from the Buddhism of Mahavihara in Anuradhapura. Yeah, that was the center from which all of those kinds of Buddhism stemmed from, right? Well. And that was like, what happened was, after the Buddha passed away, there weren't any schools, right? There was just Dhamma, there was a Buddha, they were just practicing Buddha. And in the time of Ashoka, there was missionaries sent out from Pataliputta to the different regions, right? But they weren't like different schools, they were just different people, right? So they just chose the best monks who were teachers and so on, and they sent them to the different regions, and the schools kind of evolved from that. So the